It's Tuned to Yesterday with an hour of collection curios. I'm Mark Levonier. The old-time radio collection at WRVO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape. There's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's golden age, but among the shelves are a series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, or at the very least, on the air in a very long time. This should prove to be a mysterious hour and at times strange, as later we'll hear Bela Lugosi as Dracula, and an episode of Dreadful John at Midnight. But right now, a program that sounds like something from the top 40 of investigative-style radio dramas that had a finite time on the air. Deadline Mystery told the story of columnist Lucky Larson, who sleuthed his way through two-fisted tales Sunday afternoons at 2 with actor Steve Dunn as the lead. And the detective role was seemingly in good hands for the crime genre, as Dunn famously would go on to replace radio actor Howard Duff in the heralded detective series The Adventures of Sam Spade. After Duff and author Dashiell Hammett, who created Spade, became the target of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which began to investigate them for communist sympathies after they were both listed in the infamous pamphlet Red Channels, which targeted Hollywood producers, writers, and actors during the fever pitch of the anti-communist movement of the late 1940s and early 50s. One of radio's most beloved private detective programs, particularly due to Howard Duff as Sam Spade, buckled under the pressure and replaced Duff with Steve Dunn, who was in the terrible position of filling shoes, or let's say gumshoes, that were too big for any actor at that point. Though this story sadly seems to be the one most associated with Steve Dunn on radio, he did have a decent amount of success on screen in movies and television, and this next broadcast of Deadline Mystery marks his first leading role in a radio series. This was first heard on August 10, 1947 on ABC.
From Hollywood, the Knox Company, worldwide distributors of scientifically compounded pharmaceutical products, presents Stephen Dunn, star of Columbia Pictures in Deadline Mystery.
Lucky Larson's the name, columnist for over 250 newspapers syndicated all over the world. You know, even a newspaper man's got to eat, although to look at most of us, you'd never know we do. It isn't the fact that we don't make enough money, it's because we never have the time. But I'm different. I'm a guy who takes his time. Right now, there's an awfully big mess cooking on the stove of my little apartment. And who's frying? Lucia, a classy little dame who followed me to Sicily a couple of months ago to kill me because she thought I'd killed a guy who thought she loved. Brother, she can kill me with her pizza anytime. Pizza, that savory dish that tastes and smells of old Italy. Garlic, tomatoes, gooey dough and cheese. And, of course, the sauce. Wine ripe and smackable.
You want to taste it, Lucky?
Are you kidding, baby?
There. Mm-hmm. Is it all right?
Just stick your finger in it, baby. It'll be perfect.
Oh, Lucky. I love to cook for you. You like everything I make.
Oh, you give it such pretty trimmings.
Oh, Lucky, you're sweet.
Come here.
Oh, Lucky, pizza, it'll burn.
Forget it.
Lucky, the doorbell.
Forget the doorbell.
Mm-hmm. Lucky, you'd better go. I think the doorbell's stuck.
Oh, okay. I open the door and run right into a story. There's a kid standing here. The blood running down his face paints out his features. He could be anybody until I hear his voice.
Lucky, Mr. Larson, can I come in?
Johnny Hines, what a... Of course, kid, come on in.
Thanks, Mr. Larson.
What happened, Johnny? You hit a truck?
No,
Look, don't try to talk right now. Come on, we'll go wash up.
Who is it, Lucky?
Oh!
The kid's hurt, honey. You want to give me a hand?
Oh, well, that's awful. What happened? Who is he, Lucky?
Friend of mine. Kid I used to know. We lived in the same apartment house once.
Well, don't just stand there. Get some bandages.
Yeah.
Get some iodine. Get anything.
Lucia's soft touch does more for the kid than all the bandages in the world. What that girl can't do with a Band-Aid. Johnny's patches even have trimmings. He can talk now.
Come on, son. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, who beat you up, Johnny, and why?
They beat me up because Mom doesn't want to move.
You mean somebody's trying to chase you out of the place where you live now?
Yes, sir. Mr. Quinn's been trying to get us out for weeks.
Oh, Oh, I don't believe it, Johnny.
But he has, Mr. Larson. He's done all kinds of things, like turning off the gas, stopping the water.
Oh, look, Johnny, that doesn't sound like Quinn. I've known the guy for years. He was the best landlord I ever had.
He's different now. He's so different that we want to move. Only we can't find any place to go.
Doesn't seem possible.
He's already chased the people out across the hall, the Winstons. They had to go to a trailer camp. And the people next door to us had to move in with relatives.
Sound like you're telling the truth, Johnny, but it just doesn't make sense.
Mom's sick. We've just got
to
stay.
Quinn's never been like that. Why, I've known him to carry tenants for months without even a cent of rent.
What'll we do, Mr. Larson?
What happened tonight, Johnny?
Well, I told Mr. Quinn that if he didn't leave Mom alone, I was coming to see you.
Is that why he beat you up?
Oh, no, sir. Mr. Quinn didn't do it.
Who did?
I don't know. Some big guy stopped me on the street as I was coming here. He said he'd teach me that this neighborhood wasn't going to be healthy for squealers like me.
Just a minute, John. I pick up the phone and dial Quinn's number. I have to wait a few minutes. Hey, you look better with your face washed, kid. Hello, Joe. Lucky Larson. That's funny. Joe Quinn has always been glad to hear from me before. Now he comes through and asks me how I am, why I don't ever come around. I'm coming around now, Joe. I just wanted to be sure you'd be in. Quinn says he's just going out. You better wait for me, Joe. I'll be there in 15 minutes.
But, Lucky, the pizza...
Keep it hot, baby. I won't be long. And don't change your lipstick while I'm going, huh?
Here is a message of special importance to men and women who suffer from backache. To people who feel nervous and jumpy. People who are losing their pep because of restless sleep. People who get up in the morning as tired as when they went to bed. To people who suffer from muscular aches and pains and feel a lot older than their years. If these conditions arise from an accumulation of excess acids due to a non-organic and non-systemic disorder of kidney function, the very first dose of the diuretic formula called Systex, C-Y-S-T-E-X, usually goes right to work helping nature clear away irritating excess acids and poisons. And this natural action may quickly bring an almost amazing increase in pep, a delightful easing of backache, nervousness, and a handicapping muscular pains. Then you can feel younger and get more fun out of life. Because it may bring such a vast improvement in your physical well-being, you owe it to yourself to try Systex today. Take exactly as directed on the package. See how fast it works. Your money back is guaranteed unless you're completely satisfied. So get Systex, C-Y-S-T-E-X, from your druggist today. See how much Systex may help you. And now, back to Lucky Larson and Deadline Mystery.
I'm at Quinn's apartment house now. I pull up and park. As I turn the motor off, a guy steps out of the shadows and points with a gun. I shove the door handle down. I roll to the street. The shot I expect doesn't come. Instead, the whole building falls on my head. Slowly, ever so slowly, the lights come back on again. There's a buzzsaw going around in my brain, and every one of the teeth takes out a nick as the thing goes round and round. Gradually, the buzzsaw turns into a hum, and I realize I'm all cramped up and riding in a car. I'm lying on the bottom under somebody's feet. Yeah, definitely feet. Way up somewhere, I hear voices.
When you get the Eagle Point, put him behind the wheel and start the car and jump.
Oh, how am I going to be sure he'll be killed?
Don't be a sap. There's a drop there at 200 feet.
Oh yeah.
Then I stop the car. Let me out. I got another job.
I open my eyes a slit. Oh, it's too dark. Can't make out his mug. The lug grinds his heel into my ribs. I grit and take it. I got to. Can't fight two guys with two guns. Not with me lying on the floor, anyway. Car starts up again. I'd give up all of Lucia's pizza just to stretch once. But I don't dare. Not yet. The car goes on for miles. Reached Eagle Point. The guy leaves his motor running, gets out. He comes around and opens my door. I grab his ankle, give it a twist. He dives into the gravel. My luck runs out. I lose my hold. I pull myself over into the driver's seat and grab the wheel. The headlights stab at the cliff edge, not 15 feet away. Through their back wash, I see the mug grabbing for his gun. I don't want it, but I got it. I throw the car in gear, twist the wheel hard, and step on the gas. Cliff jumps right up at me. I say I'm not going to make it. I slide over in the seat and push the door open and slide out onto air or land. Yeah, I win that toss. Way down below, I hear a terrible crash. Out of the dark behind me, I hear a curse and a laugh.
So long, Larson. So long. Ooh, my ankle.
I ride back into town on my thumb. Right now, I'm pushing the bell of Joe Quinn's apartment. Joe takes his time coming to the door. Before he opens it, he has to unlock it. Well, that's funny, too. Quinn never used to lock his door.
Lucky. It is you.
Yeah, Joe. Pretty healthy-looking ghost.
But I...
Joe, what makes you think he can get by with assaulting tenants?
But I never...
Wait a minute. I'm coming in.
Oh, please, Lucky. I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't lie, Joe. I already know about three of your tenants. How you had them beaten up in order to get them out.
You've got to believe me, Lucky. I never had anybody beat up.
Look, I saw Johnny Hines' face tonight, Joe. He came and told me all about it. And about the Winstons and the people next door.
Johnny lied to you, Lucky. Johnny was caught tonight trying to strip a car. He put up a fight and the guy who owned the car kicked his face in.
I don't believe it.
Okay. Then come with me to Mrs. Hines' apartment and she'll tell you that that's the truth.
Mrs. Hines is frightened, petrified, but she sticks to her story.
What Mr. Quinn says is true, Mr. Larson.
It smells like a mackerel.
It was dreadful of Johnny getting himself into trouble and then putting the blame on poor Mr. Quinn.
Is Johnny home? I'd like to talk to him.
Well, yes, of course. I'll call him.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mr. Larson. That's right.
You were caught stealing parts from cars, Johnny?
Yeah. Yeah, a couple of guys made me do it.
Who were they?
Well, I don't know. I never saw them before.
Please, Mr. Larson. Please forgive Johnny for getting you mixed up in this thing.
The dive I almost took over the cliff wasn't funny.
I know. But if you don't report him to the police, I'll promise you he'll go straight. I promise.
What are you going to do with a sick woman and her only kid? Okay, but there's still something screwy about this deal. For instance, how does it happen these mugs are waiting for me when I got to Quinn's apartment?
I called them after you left your place and told them how I'd loused things up.
Quit lying, Johnny. If you call them, then you know their names.
Well, not exactly. They're called Mike and Red.
Where'd you call them?
They hang out at Harry's place.
Of course, kid, you know I'm going to check on that. I do. The barman at Harry's place never heard of Mike and Red. He hasn't had a phone call for him either, not ever. It proves what I already know, that Johnny Hines is lying for some reason. Well, I'd better go home, have a bath, and think things out. And besides, I'm getting late for the pizza. I open my door and... I smell burnt Italy. I run to the kitchen. Every pan is charcoal crisp. Every burner is on. Lucia's out. She's been mad at me before, but never that mad. Besides, she never gets mad at me for running out. She always knows I run right back. I dial her number. No answer. Something's wrong. I try a taxi stand. Hello? Jet a cab over to 350 Park Avenue, will you? Huh? Hello? What? Well, where'd you go, baby? Lucia tells me that Johnny lied about Mr. Quinn. She says that after I left, Johnny called two guys. He called them Red and Mike. Lucia says that Johnny said something to them about lousing things up. Hey, wait a minute, baby. Where'd he call them? She says Johnny called them at Harry's place. Yeah, okay, baby. I'll tell Papa. Who's holding a gun at your back? I check the operator. Can you trace that call, honey? She says no. My door rings. It's the cab. I get over to Quinn's apartment. Quick.
Lucky. Are you crazy? It's 1 o'clock.
Never mind, Joe. We're going to have words.
Lucky, I'm a nice guy, but I don't have to stand for this.
You got any ideas?
Yes. I'm going to throw you out.
I beat him to the punch. I'll try to be funny, Quinn. I grab his wrist and show him what the Marines taught
me. Don't, Lucky. I'll talk.
That's what you should have done a long time ago.
It's not my fault. I couldn't help it. Honest, Lucky.
That isn't what I want to hear.
It's a gang, Lucky. They're moving in on all the apartments in this district.
How do they work it?
Well, they force the tenants out and demand huge bonuses from people who are desperate for homes.
You mean you stand for that?
I couldn't help it. They beat me up, too. And they threatened to burn me out.
What's your cut?
Oh, I haven't taken a chance. Honest, Lucky, I haven't.
Who are they?
The only one I know is the contact man. They call him Mike. He was here when you first called me tonight.
I see.
Yeah, he called someone else and told them to lay for you. Then he went to your place and got Johnny Hines.
Go on, add up some more.
Mike was in the apartment when we went to talk to Johnny and his mother tonight. That's why they lied.
What about Lucia, the girl who was at my place? They got her, too?
They went back to get her when you told Johnny that you were going to check his story.
I'm ashamed of you, Joe. You should have gone to the police the first time these guys came to you. You know, you're a savage.
Why? I'll do anything now, Lucky. Anything. Wait, I'll call the police right now.
Don't touch the phone.
Why not?
I gotta find Lucia first. If I don't, I'll never find her.
Yes, but how?
You'll go down to headquarters with me, Joe. We'll look at some pictures. Maybe you'll be able to pick out this, this Mike.
Yeah, I'll go.
If I can find that guy, I'll make him talk. We start for the door. We get about 2 feet and Joe yells.
Look out, Lucky! Look out!
As the shot, Quinn goes down. I whirl around. The lights go out. I jump to somewhere else as 2 more shots hit the air where I'd been. Grab a chair and hurl it towards the door. The guy yells as the chair connects. I run towards the door and fall over my own chair. I get up, I hear the door slammed, hand locked. I know that by the time I find another exit, the guy will be gone. Oh, well. I turn on the light and take a look at Joe Quinn. I call the ambulance. A dark, nasty hole in his shoulder is crying red tears.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard about Systex for backache, for muscular aches and pains, for nervousness, for loss of pep and sleep, for that tired, worn-out feeling when due to a non-systemic and non-organic disorder of kidney function. But have you tried Systex? That's spelled C-Y-S-T-E-X. Until you do, you can't know how fast it may work to help nature curb your backache and muscular pains, bring you greater pep, allay nervousness, improve your physical well-being. Clinical tests in many cases, even on people up to the advanced age of 80, prove that Systex helps a high percentage of those who give it a fair trial. And because Systex is so successful, it is now one of the accepted medicines in many countries throughout the world. For over 20 years, Systex has brought joyous help to millions of men and women. So surely you'll make no mistake in at least giving Systex a fair trial under the guarantee of money back unless completely satisfied. So get Systex, C-Y-S-T-E-X, from your druggist and take exactly as directed on the package. See how much Systex may help you. And now back to Lucky Larson and Deadline Mystery.
I step down to the Hines apartment. All I find is a note on the door. It says, "Gone out of town. No milk, please." Fine, fine. There's no one who can identify the gang's contact man, unless I can find the Winstons or the couple next door. Fat chance of that. I haven't the glimmer of an idea where they are. As for Joe Quinn, he won't be talking for a long, long time. Maybe never. I go back to Joe's apartment just as the meat wagon boys get there, and the cops. My old friend Lieutenant Tom Burns is pushing them around.
Hi, Lucky. Was that you who called the station?
Yeah, Tom.
Yeah, Quinn's got a bad hole in him.
Yeah, I know.
Who did it?
I don't know. Somebody took a shot at him from the door. Threw some lead at me, too. Put out the lights. I couldn't see who he was.
Uh-huh.
I don't dare tell Tom what I know, not yet. If I do, the gang will kill Lucia, just as sure as taxes. Tom, why don't you get a fingerprint guy up here?
Already sent for him, Lucky. Oh, are you expecting a call?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, this is Larson. A dirty voice on the other end tells me that if I like that dame of mine, I'd better button my lip, keep it buttoned. Yeah. Yeah, it's a deal. Only be sure you keep your part of the bargain, pal.
Well, that's that, Lucky. Not a print in this room that wasn't made by you or Quinn.
Oh, but there's got to be. There's got to.
What are you so upset about? Quinn isn't going to die.
I still want to find out who did it.
Well, Quinn will be able to talk in a few days. Maybe he'll be able to tell you.
A few days isn't soon enough.
Look here, Lucky. Are you holding out on me?
Let me borrow your fingerprint, man, will you, Tom?
What for?
Don't ask questions. If we find anything, I'll bring it straight to you.
No?
I'll tell you everything I know, honest, Tom.
Sorry, Lucky. That isn't good enough.
Tom, you gotta trust me.
Sorry, Lucky. No.
But if I tell you now, it'll leak. I'll be scooped. Now, look, Tom. I've helped you out a couple of times.
Well, okay, go ahead.
Thanks, Tom. The fingerprint man and I get into his car. When we're down the road a couple of blocks, I say, drive to Eagle Point, son. We're going to get some prints off the wheel of a car about 200 feet down.
Okay, Lucky, we've matched the prints.
Good, good, Tom. I knew you would.
It belonged to a hood who's done at least a dozen raps.
Who is it?
No. Not until you come across, Lucky.
Okay, if that's the only way.
I'm afraid it is.
Well, look, I'm trying to run down a story on a gang that's trying to promote a home renting racket.
Hey, isn't that a new one?
Just an old one with a new twist. The Shakedown racket. These are the guys who shot Joe Quinn, Tom. They also beat up young Johnny Hines. Then they kidnapped him and his mother, along with a friend of mine.
Well, why didn't you tell me this before?
Because they killed a whole bunch, if they think I've talked.
Well, come on, let's go get them.
Tom, look, I got to handle this alone. I've got to find this guy and make him tell me who's at the top. You can understand. Got to use my own methods. Methods that, well, you can't use. No time to bring the guy into headquarters and make him sweat. So, come on, Tom. Let me know who belongs to these prints, huh?
Yeah. Well, Lucky, you're always asking me to break the rules. Go ahead. The prints came off of Frankie Rolls.
Frankie?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Tom, thanks. I'll be seeing you.
Hey, wait a minute. How are you going to find him?
I know guys who'll sing for a sawbuck. This song's worth a century. I drop into an all-night pillory, pay a nickel for a phone booth. I'm calling a stool. Hiya, Squint. Lucky Larson. Hey, Squint, I got $100 that says you don't know where I can find Frankie Rolls. The guy sniffs a couple of times, gives me an address. Well, what do you know? You don't mean it. You know, Squint, I'll go broke if I keep on losing bets like that. I'll put the money in the mail after I've seen Frankie. So don't give him the tip. The address Squint gave me is a pretty nifty neighborhood. Too nifty for the Frankie Rolls I used to know. Looks like this new racket is really paying off. I find the right window and slip my knife under the catch. Easy now, Lucky, easy. There. My pencil flash pokes around the room. It looks empty and safe. I give the window another shove. Wow! I didn't count on an alarm. It's too late to back out now. Anyway, who wants to? I climb in, scurry across the room. I get back at the door just as somebody throws it open. The lights go on.
All right, you. Come out from behind that door.
Huh?
And don't try any tricks. I can see every move you make in the mirror.
I step out, right into a guy with a gun. Well, surprise. This isn't Frankie Rolls. It's a lawyer by the name of Lamson Holliday. I've interviewed him at least a dozen times. Well, hiya, counselor.
Larson, the columnist. I know you.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you mean, breaking into my house? Trying to steal some papers from one of my cases?
I'm wondering if Squint gave me the runaround on this tip. Holliday's a respected mouthpiece, more or less, even if he does defend crooks.
Well, speak up, Larson.
I listen to the burglar alarm. I figure I can't get in any worse. Well, I'll tell you, counselor. I'm looking for a crook by the name of Frankie Rolls.
You expect to find him here?
Yeah, that's what the boys in the back room tell me.
Just a minute. Let me turn this thing off. You get around, Larson.
Then he is here.
Sure. Just step through that door. I'll take you up.
Holliday prods me with his gun. We go up some stairs.
Come on out, Frankie. We've got company.
A door opens down the hall. A silhouette steps out, framed by the light, and back its shape is the same as the guy who came at me this evening out of the shadows with a gun.
Who is it, Holliday?
Well, he didn't exactly say he was a friend of yours.
Lucky Larson.
Unlock the guest room, Frankie. That's the right place for a guest, isn't it?
Yeah. Lots of guests use this room.
You always have a Yale spring lock on your guest room,
Sonny? Come on, Snowpuck, get on in there.
I step past Frankie. Turn. It's an old Marine trick. I grab his arm, yank him into the room, and slam the door. The Yale lock snaps.
Hey, let go of my arm. Break of my arm.
How'd you guess it, stinker?
Oh.
All right, where's your gun?
I ain't got a gun. Now, let go.
Not in a million years, pal.
Larson, if you come out, I'll make a deal with you.
I don't believe in Santa Claus.
If you don't come out, I'll shoot the lock off.
That's okay with me. I'm holding Frankie against the door.
I'll give you 3 seconds.
Hey, don't shoot, boss. But Larson says it's true.
I pull Frankie back as 2 shots come through. You're a lousy shot, Holiday. You missed.
Hey, let me loose, Lucky. Let me loose.
If you don't want me to shove you back in his line of fire, you better talk fast, Snicker.
I tell you, I don't know anything.
Where's the girl and the others?
I don't know.
The rat's beginning to squeak, Holiday. He'll make a swell witness at your trial. You'll have to do better than that, Counselor. You gonna tell me, Frankie?
I don't know.
Okay, Holiday. I'm gonna hold Frankie up in the center of the door. If you don't want to hear him in court, you better not miss. I give Frankie's arm another twist and start pushing him over.
I'll tell you what you want to know.
Where are they?
They're in our closet over there.
Okay, Holiday. Shoot. Brother, are you lousy?
Don't think that's all the bullets I've got. I'm loading up again.
I measure the distance to Frankie's jaw and swing. Frankie sighs and takes a nap. You better hurry with that reloading, Holiday. I'm coming out. Drop it, Counselor. I can beat a shell to the chamber.
1 second and I'll let you have it. What's that?
Haven't you ever heard of a doorbell?
Who could be
calling? The answer to your burglar alarm, Holiday. Right now, I'd say your yard is lousy with cops.
Cops?
Yeah. You're in kind of a spot, brother.
What do you mean?
What are you going to do, Holiday? You've either got to go and answer that bell or the cops will break down the door.
Yeah? Well, I've got another choice.
If you mean taking a pot at me, sure, but the house is surrounded, Holiday. They'll get you for murder.
Open up! We're coming in.
Too bad, Holiday. A respected lawyer like you should have had more respect for the law.
Open up! Open up!
Your bartending days are over.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Holiday, don't be a fool. Drop that gun.
Now, I had time to get one bullet in the chamber.
You can't quit. Yeah. One bullet's enough. Go back into the guest room, dig out the keys out of Frankie's pocket, and unlock the closet door. Lucia falls out into my arms. Quickly, I take out the gag. There you are, baby. You still think I'm sweet?
Oh, go ahead, Lucky. Go ahead and prove it.
Where's Johnny and his mother, baby?
In there. They're all right.
Good. I untie Lucia's hands and feet. She can't cook pizza without hands.
All right, where are you? It's the police.
Be out in a minute, Tom. Got a little unfinished business.
Oh, Lucky. Lucky.
It's all right, baby. Well, I guess we better go out and face him, huh?
Oh, it's you, Lucky.
Yeah. Ain't I the little cut up, though?
What I want to know is who shot Lamson Holiday and why.
Well, that's easy, Tom. He shot himself.
Yeah? What for?
His rent racket went up too fast. He knew he was going to be evicted. Column for today, Sunday, August the 10th, 1947. Deadline by Lucky Larson. Say, have you a little racket in your home? Whom are you paying off right now? Do you know a guy who knows a guy who knows where Aunt Minnie can get an apartment if she marries a veteran and buys $25 worth of furniture for $500? I know one who'll even furnish the veteran. How about that racket little Jimmy's got when he makes your boyfriend give him a nickel to get him out of the parlor? You can stop little Jimmy's racket by patting his pants and leading him out the front door by his ear. You can stop all the other rackets, too, if you'll just call a cop. The cop's got the best protection racket there is. And all it costs you is taxes. You know, little rackets turn into big rackets, and big rackets turn into wars. So be smart. Call a cop while they're still small, huh? You know, at one time, one lonely little cop could have stopped Hitler. Yeah, that's dirty.
Here is a vitally important message to those who suffer from recurring attacks of bronchial asthma. Most people who suffer from the coughing and struggle to breathe, who can't sleep at night and thus lose strength and energy, have had these recurring attacks a long time. They've tried a lot of things, and still they cough, wheeze, and struggle to breathe. Naturally, they become skeptical and think nothing will help them. But I firmly believe there is hope for even the most pessimistic, because I have seen letters from all over the world, from grateful men and women, telling how thankful they were that they got up enough courage to try Mendaco. That's spelled M-E-N-D-A-C-O. And I've seen a large number of clinical reports, which convince me that Mendaco has been a blessing to sufferers from recurring attacks of bronchial asthma. There are certain scientific reasons why Mendaco works the way it does. And the producers of this great medicine are so confident it will help most sufferers from recurring attacks of bronchial asthma that they say, get Mendaco from your druggist and take exactly as directed on the package. If you're not completely satisfied, your money back is guaranteed immediately. For coughing, recurring attacks of bronchial asthma, get Mendaco, M-E-N-D-A-C-O. Ask your druggist for Mendaco today. Listen next week at the same time when the Knox Company, worldwide distributors of Systex, the modern kidney diuretic, and Mendaco for recurring attacks of bronchial asthma, presents another exciting adventure of Lucky Larson starring Stephen Dunn through arrangements with Columbia Pictures, producers of Down to Earth. Deadline Mystery is directed by Dave Titus and written by Fred Howard. Today's episode was based on an original story by Robert Neffel. Included in today's cast were June Whitley as Lucia, Sam Edwards as Johnny Hines, Jack Crucian as Frankie Rawls, John Frank as Joe Quinn, and Byron Kane as Lieutenant Tom Burns. Original music was composed and played by Len Salvo. The events and characters depicted in this story were entirely fictional, and any resemblance to actual places or people, living or dead, is entirely coincidental. Frank Hemingway speaking. This program came to you from Hollywood. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Deadline Mystery, from August 10, 1947. Much like leading actor Steve Dunn's future role as Radio Sam Spade, it didn't last too long. Deadline Mystery was only broadcast for 4 months on ABC. You're listening to an hour of collection curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Levonier. While I was pursuing the tapes in our collection, I came across a title that I just had to put on the rack based on its provocative name, Dreadful John at Midnight. And it turns out that this was a student production that came out of Columbia University in the early 1960s on their station, WKCR, and it's endured among radio horror enthusiasts as being a pretty unique show that has survived through the years and many generations of tape. The program featured readings of some classic and modern horror stories read by John Morrow and would be as long as the short story took to tell. The show is produced with a radio tradition that has also endured for many years in other countries and for a time in the States, where just reading a story with light sound design was enough to entertain. Here's a broadcast from the series called The Boarded Window.
Dreadful John at Midnight. Let me tell you a few things about this morning's author. A born adventurer, Ambrose Bierce joined the Indiana Infantry in 1861 and fought courageously throughout the Civil War. Then he went to San Francisco, where he followed his chosen profession of journalist and became editor of the News Letter. His aggressiveness and sharp-tongued wit stood him in good stead, and his stories and sketches won great popularity. His success dimmed somewhat as he grew older, but his adventurous spirit remained untamed. At the age of 75, he went off to Mexico to join Villa's band of revolutionists. He was never heard of again. This morning, it is my pleasure to read for you The Boarded Window by Ambrose Bierce. In 1830, only a few miles away from what is now the great city of Cincinnati, lay an immense and almost unbroken forest. The whole region was sparsely settled by people of the frontier, restless souls who no sooner had hewn fairly habitable homes out of the wilderness and attained to that degree of prosperity, which today we should call indigence, than, impelled by some mysterious impulse of their nature, they abandoned all and pushed farther westward to encounter new perils and privations in the effort to regain the meager comforts which they had voluntarily denounced. Many of them had already forsaken that region for the remoter settlement, but among those remaining was one who had been of those first arriving. He lived alone in a house of logs, surrounded on all sides by the great forest, of whose gloom and silence he seemed a part, for no one had ever known him to smile nor to speak a needless word. His simple wants were supplied by the sale or barter of skins of wild animals in the river town, for not a thing did he grow upon the land which, if needful, he might have claimed by right of undisturbed possession. There were evidences of improvement. A few acres of ground immediately about the house had once been cleared of its trees, the decayed stumps of which were half concealed by the new growth that had been suffered to repair the ravage wrought by the axe. Apparently, the man's zeal for agriculture had burned with a failing flame, expiring in penitential ashes. The little log house, with its chimney of sticks, its roof of warping clapboards weighted with traversing poles, and its chinking of clay, had a single door and, directly opposite, a window. The latter, however, was boarded up. No one could remember a time when it was not, and none knew why it was so closed. Certainly not because of the occupant's dislike of light and air, for on those rare occasions when a hunter had passed that lonely spot, the recluse had commonly been seen sunning himself on his doorstep if heaven had provided sunshine for his need. I fancy there are few persons living today who ever knew the secret of that window, but I am one, as you shall see. The man's name was said to be Murlock. He was apparently 70 years old, actually about 50. Something besides years had had a hand in his aging. His hair and long, full beard were white. His gray, lusterless eyes sunken. His face singularly seamed with wrinkles which appeared to belong to two intersecting systems. In figure, he was tall and spare, with a stoop of the shoulders, a burden bearer. I never saw him. These particulars I learned from my grandfather, from whom also I got the man's story when I was a lad. He had known him when living nearby in that early day. One day, Murlock was found in his cabin, dead. It was not a time and place for coroners and newspapers, and I suppose it was agreed that he had died from natural causes, or I should have been told and should remember. I know only that with what was probably a sense of the fitness of things, the body was buried near the cabin alongside the grave of his wife, who had preceded him by so many years that local tradition had retained hardly a hint of her existence. That closes the final chapter of this true story, excepting, indeed, the circumstance that many years afterward, in company with an equally intrepid spirit, I penetrated to the place and ventured near enough to the ruined cabin to throw a stone against it, and ran away to avoid the ghost, which every well-informed boy thereabout knew haunted the spot. But there is an earlier chapter, that supplied by my grandfather. When Murlock built his cabin and began laying sturdily about with his axe to hew out a farm, the rifle, meanwhile, his means of support, he was young, strong, and full of hope. In that eastern country whence he came, he had married, as was the fashion, a young woman and always worthy of his honest devotion, who shared the dangers and privations of his lot with a willing spirit and light heart. There is no known record of her name. Of her charms of mind and person, tradition is silent, and the doubter is at liberty to entertain his doubt. But God forbid that I should share it. Of their affection and happiness, there is abundant assurance in every added day of the man's widowed life, for what but the magnetism of a blessed memory could have chained that venturesome spirit to a lot like that. One day, Murlock returned from gunning in a distant part of the forest to find his wife prostrate with fever and delirium. There was no physician within miles, no neighbor, nor was she in a condition to be left to summon help. So he set about the task of nursing her back to health, but at the end of the third day, she fell into unconsciousness and so passed away, apparently, with never a gleam of returning reason. From what we know of a nature like his, when they venture to sketch in some of the details of the outline picture drawn by my grandfather. When convinced that she was dead, Murlock had sense enough to remember that the dead must be prepared for burial. In performance of this sacred duty, he blundered now and again, did certain things incorrectly, and others which he did correctly were done over and over. His occasional failures to accomplish some simple and ordinary act filled him with astonishment, like that of a drunken man who wonders at the suspension of familiar natural laws. He was surprised, too, that he did not weep, surprised and a little ashamed. Surely it is unkind not to weep for the dead. Tomorrow, he said aloud, I shall have to make the coffin and dig the grave, and then I shall miss her when she is no longer in sight. But now, she is dead, of course. But it is all right. It must be all right somehow. Things cannot be so bad as they seem. He stood over the body in the fading light, adjusting the hair and putting the finishing touches to the simple toilet, doing all mechanically, with soulless care. And still, through his consciousness, ran an undersense of conviction that all was right, that he should have her again as before, and everything explained. He had had no experience in grief. His capacity had not been enlarged by use. His heart could not contain it all, nor his imagination rightly conceive it. He did not know he was so hard struck. That knowledge would come later and never go. Grief is an artist of powers as various as the instruments upon which he plays his dirges for the dead, evoking from some the sharpest, shrillest notes, from others the low, grave chords that throb recurrent like the slow beating of a distant drum. Some natures it startles, some it stupefies. To one it comes like the stroke of an arrow, stinging all the sensibilities to a keener life. To another as the blow of a bludgeon, which in crushing benumbs. We may conceive Murlock to have been that way affected, for, and here we're upon surer ground than that of conjecture, no sooner had he finished his pious work than, sinking into a chair by the side of the table upon which the body lay, and noting how white the profile showed in the deepening gloom, he laid his arms upon the table's edge and dropped his face into them, tearless yet and unutterably weary. At that moment came in through the open window a long, wailing sound like the cry of a lost child in the far deeps of the darkening wood. But the man did not move. Again, and nearer than before, sounded that unearthly cry upon his failing sense. Perhaps it was a wild beast. Perhaps it was a dream, for Murlock was asleep. Some hours later, as it afterward appeared, this unfaithful watcher awoke and, lifting his head from his arms, intently listened. He knew not why. There in the black darkness by the side of the dead, recalling all without a shock, he strained his eyes to see he knew not what. His senses were all alert. His breath was suspended. His blood had stilled its tides as if to assist the silence. Who, what had awakened him, and where was it? Suddenly, the table shook beneath his arms. And at the same moment he heard, or fancied that he heard, a light, soft step. Another, sounds of bare feet upon the floor. He was terrified beyond the power to cry out or move. Perforce he waited, waited there in the darkness through seeming centuries of such dread as one may know, yet live to tell. He tried vainly to speak the dead woman's name, vainly to stretch forth his hand across the table to learn if she were there. His throat was powerless. His arms and hands were like lead. Then occurred something most frightful. Some heavy body seemed hurled against the table with an impetus that pushed it against his breast so sharply as nearly to overthrow him. And at the same instant, he heard and felt the fall of something upon the floor with so violent a thump that the whole house was shaken by the impact. A scuffling ensued, and a confusion of sounds impossible to describe. Murlock had risen to his feet. Here, had by excess forfeited control of his faculties, he flung his hands upon the table. Nothing was there. There is a point at which terror may turn to madness, and madness incites to action. With no definite intent, from no motive but the wayward impulse of a madman, Murlock sprang to the wall. With a little groping, seized his loaded rifle, and without aim, discharged. By the flash, which lit up the room with a vivid illumination, he saw an enormous panther dragging the dead woman toward the window, its teeth fixed in her throat. Then there were darkness, blacker than before, and silence. And when he returned to consciousness, the sun was high and the wood vocal with songs of birds. The body lay near the window where the beast had left it when frightened away by the flash and report of the rifle. The clothing was deranged, the long hair in disorder, the limbs lay anyhow. From the throat, dreadfully lacerated, had issued a pool of blood not yet entirely coagulated. The ribbon with which he had bound the wrists was broken. The hands were tightly clenched. Between the teeth was a fragment of the animal's ear. I've had the pleasure of reading for you The Boarded Window by Ambrose Bierce. I now have the pleasure of praying with you all, from ghoulies and ghosties and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night. Dear Lord, deliver us, at least until this same time next week.
Dreadful John at Midnight is produced and directed by Clive Thomas Cuthbertson. This is King's Crown Radio.
Dreadful John at Midnight, from the early 1960s, broadcast on Columbia University's WKCR. Director Clive Thomas Cuthbertson would go on to be a well-known media presence in Central Florida in the 1980s as Clive Thomas, a measured television newscaster in the morning and in the afternoon on radio, an agitated talk show host, adored by both audiences. And to close this hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday, I came across something that is self-explanatory, but still its own mystery. Actor Bela Lugosi will forever be remembered for his portrayal as Dracula in the 1931 film of the same name, even though he appeared in the movies only four times as the character, twice in comedy films by Abbott and Costello. He is still considered the quintessential man behind the cape. This next piece of audio sounds like it could have been from a radio show or even a short film feature, but where it lands in the context of what it may have been a part of, I have no idea. The short bit is listed on the tape as Bela Lugosi and surely encapsulates what our Collection Curio series is for. Here it is.
You're not frightened. I'm your old friend, Bela Lugosi, better known as the fiendish vampire, Count Dracula. If I have frightened you in this character, it is because I portrayed it just as I learned about it at my birthplace in Transylvania. And as the legend goes, if you believe in it, don't think that you are safe from vampires. Oh, no. Supernatural beings are not chained to their graves. They are free to roam the entire world, and even to seek their victims right here. The vampire feeds by night on the blood of the living. Daybreak goes back to its coffin, which is filled with the earth of his native soil. There awaits the nightfall when it can go forth to prowl the land. And once it has chosen you as its victim, you will be pursued relentlessly until it has fastened its teeth in your throat and have drained your veins of all your blood. But there is a way to destroy a vampire. All you have to do is to drag it by day to its lair and catch it as it lies sleeping in the coffin. Then drive a stake to its heart. Very simple, isn't it? So when you lie abed tonight in your darkened room, and these thoughts give you nightmares, and you dread to look behind the curtains for fear of seeing my horrible face appear at the window, just pull yourself together and remember, after all, Well, what thing?
An unknown and undated recording of Dracula star Bela Lugosi ringing the curtain down on this hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday. Be with us again for more unique shows and recordings from radio's past. I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening. Thank you.